and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris. Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. July 11th marks World Population Day, which aims to draw global attention towards rising world population and the effect that it is putting on our natural resources and the climate, as well as the planet overall. Now, over the next half an hour, we'll explore the challenges, the opportunities, and the potential solutions surrounding population dynamics, reproductive rights, and the pursuit of a sustainable and equitable future for all. My first guest today is Professor Tan Sri Dr. Jamila Mahmood, Executive Director at the Sunway Center for Planetary Health. Dr. Jamila, thank you for being on the show today. Can you begin our conversation today by maybe laying out for us how the changing global demographics and population growth might impact planetary health and sustainability?
Thank you, Melissa. Nice to be back and talking to you. Well, definitely when there is an increased population, there will be increased pressures on the planet. There will be a greater demand for resources from food to energy, water, and you know there is only a finite amount that the planet can produce for us. So this will lead to devastation of natural resources and environments to grow food, more need for energy, which may be fossil fuel derived, and very seriously as well, the water crisis that we face, compounded by climate change and climate crisis. So, you know, it's all interconnected. But I think we've got to realize that population growth is not uniform, right? It's only in certain areas. It's very much contextual to different countries. And in some countries, probably there is a need to grow the population, whereas in some countries, there's a drastic need to maybe manage it better. So it's also related to socioeconomic equity. People who are not given opportunities on family planning or any rights over their bodies to decide and how many children they want, obviously this is going to cause a problem.
Right. I'm so glad that you brought up the nuances of how global demographics are changing. I read somewhere that 2/3 of the global population are living in low fertility context. So how do we make sense of this? The fact that there is this kind of dichotomy of over the global population. There are some areas of the world that there's too many people that will accelerate the planet stressors. And then there are other areas where there's shrinking populations, low fertility context, and aging nations. So how do we think through these differences and nuances?
You said it, you hit it on the nail. It's the nuanced approach that you need, right? It's not about a one-size-fits-all. It's about looking at perspectives from national and regional levels and really, then developing policies that will support, whatever decisions that need to be taken in terms of population. Now, if you take the example, let me go from one extreme to another. If you take the example of underpopulation or aging population, right? That has a heavy burden on governments as well in terms of cost for healthcare and other things. The whole economic model tends to shift because you don't have the warm hands and bodies to do the work. Of course, we can say that probably the future robotics and AI is going to take away some of that. But when you have an aging population, you actually need a care industry, and a care industry is by people. And I think that's where that nuance and the understanding of that complexity. But I think, if you ask me, the train has left the station, right? Because it's unlikely that a country like Japan will suddenly become a positive growth of positive fertility country. So this is where, migration is actually very healthy for countries in this situation. And we should not look at, migration as something very negative. All the data points to the fact that migration has actually positively contributed to economies. Now, on the other extreme, you have then, countries with high fertility rates when resources are limited, but also where there's such great socioeconomic disparity. Now, part of the problem is obviously finding not just a short-term solution, but the long-term one, which is about basically education, right? About rights. And particularly, you know, education for girls and women. I think where, you know, countries have invested in education for girls and women, they make the right choices. They make the choices that is right for their families, for their culture, and for their own, you know, communities. And I think, you know, none of us has a right to say you cannot do this or you cannot do that. But we have a right to demand that they are given the tools. There is a long way to go. The education disparity still exists, particularly in the low income countries.
So if we were to say focus on reproductive rights, which are a fundamental aspect of population dynamics and will have a significant impact on the size, the composition, the well-being of populations. You, Dr. Jamila, have worked in the health sector as an obstetrician and gynecologist, I think, say for 25 years previously. And then you also have
involved with the production of the State of the World's Population Report before.
Definitely. And there's the intersection as well with your humanitarian work with Mercy Malaysia. What have been your observations about how reproductive rights and access to comprehensive reproductive health services can actually help address some of these social, economic, and also environmental challenges?
You know, when women are given the opportunity to make those decisions, they make good decisions. They make decisions for their families. And when you have, you know, when you actually manage populations well, you're also managing future generations well, because, you know, it's about the time they have for children, the investment they will put into their children's well-being, development, education, right? So all those things, you know, it just becomes a positive reinforcing cycle. So I think, you know, if you look at the nexus between rights and humanitarian or crisis, let's talk about the climate crisis because it's on us now, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that it's all, again, interlinked. If women are empowered to make those decisions, they will make the decisions at home around consumption, around energy use, around, you know, management of waste, and so on and so forth. So, you know, we are now living in a world where we should actually be very, very worried that we are in this crisis, which is getting, you know, it does not look as though people are taking it very, very seriously. But I think this is where women and girls make good decisions. Generally, you know, the authenticity of women's leadership is actually something that we so badly need now. The empathy, you know, for the environment, empathy for the planet, and empathy for other people as well. We all need to be in this together, right? So we need to also look at adaptations, right? Adaptation strategies, because mitigation alone for climate is not going to work. But let me give you a really scary statistic, Melissa. There was a recent report released by UNEP, which said that every year our global military spend is $2.24 trillion. Now, the amount of funding you need for climate change adaptation in 2030 is estimated anything between $160 to $240 billion. That's a fraction of military spend. By 2050, you know, our military spend will, global military spend will probably be higher, and the need then will be about $315 to $565 billion. And that military spend is to protect us from each other. I mean, it's really, you know, it doesn't make sense. When actually we are all in trouble right now, we need to protect ourselves together because we are facing a common enemy, which is the climate crisis, which we created. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of imbalances, and you know, you need that great shift of thinking and, you know, transition and leadership to steer us out of this mess.
Right, and what would you like to see, Dr. Jamila, from governments, from policymakers, from communities as well, in dealing with the issues that intersect the population growth, sustainability, and the climate crisis, and planetary health?
First of all, education. The more girls and you get into school, you know, the more girls and boys get to understand that you were in this together, that, you know, there is this finite amount of resources on this planet that we all need to share. That's very critical. Secondly, I think that for governments particularly, you have good policies, you need to implement them, and you need to monitor. So I'm really excited that Malaysia has taken a very courageous and bold step to develop a national planetary health action plan, you know, and this to me is just so amazing. It's the first country in the world to do this, and kudos to the government for making that decision. Now, when we actually develop the plan, which will be ready by, you know, next year, we need to make sure we put in a mechanism to not just monitor how we implement it, bring people along with the whole plan, but also measure our impact. And I think that requires really, you know, political will, investment. It's not going to be cheap. And I think we have to really look at where we invest our money in terms of, you know, for the rakyat and for the people, because, you know, we're all in this together, and there is only one planet, and we all need to count on each other.
All right. Thank you so much for speaking with me. And thank you to your Cat CC for joining us on the show as well. That was Professor Tan Sri Dr. Jamila Mahmud from the Sunway Centre for Planetary Health. We're going to take a quick break here and consider this. We'll be back with more. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Consider This. Let's continue our discussion on the global issues surrounding population, demographics and planetary health as we mark World Population Day 2023 on July 11th. Sustainability and climate change specialist Dr. Renard Siu joins me now. He's also an adjunct professor at UNITAR. Dr. Renard, thank you so much for being on the show with me. Can you begin our conversation with understanding how you think we, the public, should be considering the complex relationship between population growth and the climate crisis?
Yeah, sure. I think it's quite clear that, you know, an exponential population growth definitely puts a great deal of stress on our planetary systems. There is definitely an increase in resource consumption, energy demand goes up, water goes up, even land, which a lot of people tend to think of as an infinite resource, comes under pressure due to urbanization, habitat losses. So it is quite clear, right, that population growth, you know, does amplify, right, a lot of the severe impacts that we are already seeing, especially with regards to climate change. Obviously, you know, as our population increases, scientists have actually attributed climate change, right, to anthropogenic or human-based activities for industrialization, you know, the way that, you know, we are currently transporting ourselves, right, which is one of the largest sources of emissions. So all of this would actually exacerbate, right, the climate crisis to a certain extent, like, so to speak.
Okay, but population growth, as we understand it, isn't quite uniform across the world. So we have 2/3 of the global population living in low fertility contexts, whereas eight developing countries, will account for at least half of the projected population growth over the next 3 decades. Congo, Egypt, Nigeria, Ethiopia, India, Pakistan, the Philippines, and Tanzania, if I am not mistaken. So if we were to think about the number of people on the planet as consumers of resources and contributing to the climate crisis, it doesn't actually hold the more significant carbon emitters to account. How do we think that through?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite an interesting dichotomy, as you've pointed out, right? On one hand, we have overpopulation, which, you know, I've mentioned earlier, leads to a huge depletion of natural resources, increase in waste and pollution, and also habitat destruction, right? As we need more development and housing demand increases. But on the other hand, end of the spectrum, you have a shrinking population, right? Which have economic implications when it comes to, you know, the reduction of productivity, decreasing in consumer demand, and also an aging workforce to think about. I think the key here, or really central to this conversation, is really the concept of sustainability, which is really about finding, you know, the right balance, like so to speak. And this involves a lot of considerations, like in the way that economic activities are being carried out. You know, we need to start having conversations around what it means to have a sustainable population management, right? For instance, by encouraging responsible family planning, looking into accessibility to reproductive health services in order to help stabilize population growth. The other area that I've mentioned about briefly was to focus on sustainable consumption and resource management. With the amount of waste, right, that we are generating, a lot of that tends to end up in landfills, right? And as waste decomposes, right, it sends up methane. Methane is basically a potent form of greenhouse gases, right, which exacerbates the impact of climate change. And hence, we do have to think about different strategies to sort of help reduce waste, right, in order to mitigate, you know, the impacts, to cut down on waste, cut down on emissions. And then, of course, you know, like another area to consider is also to look into better master planning of our townships in order to avoid things like over-urbanization. Mm-hmm. If anything, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic have shown, you know, us that this is an area that needs to be considered, because we don't want to have another lockdown, right, where everyone has to, you know, stay at home when the pandemic breaks out, just because most of us actually live in a quite a densely populated area. So there have been a lot of conversations, a lot of strategies on how to, you know, make our lifestyles more sustainable. And it's really a whole of government and whole of society approach type of conversations that's really happening at this point in time.
Can I ask you about how social and economic factors like inequality and poverty, how does that intersect with sustainable practices and choices? I'm wondering what the implications are for climate action.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I think as climate scientists and activists, you know, one of the things that we've always brought up to the fore is that it's often the marginalized communities, those living in poverty, aging, women and children in particular, that are most vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. You know, as sea levels continue to rise, a lot of people living in coastal areas, right, have to migrate. So there's this whole concept around climate refugees that have already come up to the fore, where people are forced to move from their homes to, you know, greener pastures, just because the areas that they currently live in are no longer habitable, right? And this doesn't just affect those living in rural areas, but also those that are involved in agriculture or farming. If their land is no longer fertile enough, right, for them to plant, or if the area has been, you know, like hugely exposed to floods, droughts, what scientists consider as a double whammy effect. Sometimes they have no choice but really to migrate and look at other areas where they can actually work on agriculture or farming. So we are seeing impacts like that happening, not just on a global basis, but also in Malaysia, our own home, especially in both the northern and southern regions of Peninsula Malaysia.
Right. So in just in terms of the global context, where which specific regions or countries will likely be most impacted by these effects?
Yeah, I mean, certainly African continent is susceptible, but so is ASEAN as a region. A lot of our major cities are actually located along the coastal area, so we have high exposures, in fact, right, to severe floods and droughts. In fact, you know, if you look at statistical data, scientists have warned that we only have less than a dozen years left to cap temperatures from increasing by 1.5 degrees Celsius. Otherwise, you know, like we will be facing the brunt, right, of severe impacts like, you know, as the ones that I've mentioned earlier.
How do we think through? So climate refugees clearly is going to be a problem that the world will have to deal with going forward. How do you see the world dealing with it, particularly in just the way historically we have dealt with migration and refugees fleeing war and violence and other atrocities?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, Mel. As it stands, like the term climate refugees isn't internationally accepted. it's definitely, you know, like something that a lot of climate advocates are trying to fight for, but we're really at the nascent stage, right, in terms of trying to uncover what that looks like, right, in practice, and who are these climate refugees that are migrating. There have been some case studies that have been run, but essentially some of the key strategies that would need to be considered would be better planning and visioning around how population trends are growing, looking at hotspot areas that are more susceptible to the impacts of climate change, floods, droughts, forest fires, where, you know, like we have to actually take a deeper in-depth study into how populations are actually migrating out of these areas just because the areas that they live in are no longer habitable. And then we have to start thinking about issues around, you know, overpopulation, transportation, having better transportation systems, looking at food sufficiency ratios, because, you know, like every 1 degree Celsius of increase in temperature has been shown to actually decrease crop use, you know, by about 3 to 5% on a global basis. And we are talking about corn, you know, like maize, wheat, barley, which makes up about 2/3 of human calorific intake. The percentages look small, but essentially, if you're looking at it from a global perspective, this is a huge problem. Assuming that, you know, like population growth is going to continue to increase at an exponential rate, where are we going to be sourcing, you know, for food in order to meet the demands of this ever-growing population? And these are some serious considerations that, you know, we need to start thinking about.
All right. Okay. So what would you like to see? I mean, there's so many different aspects and moving parts in having to deal with what is going to be a continuous problem. What would you like to see policymakers, communities, politicians, all of society, in fact, deal with the fact that we need to strike a balance between sustainable population levels as well as dealing with the climate crisis and fostering kind of a sustainable development?
Yeah, at the end of the day, we need a whole of government, all of society approach. As it stands, we tend to work in silos. So you have policymakers working on, you know, drafting their own policies. You have civil society organizations coming up with campaigns. But how do we get everyone aligned, right, onto the same page to try and understand one another? You know, I think the very first step is really to get, you know, important pertinent stakeholders, voices of marginalized communities, right, on the same table to ensure that their voices are heard first and foremost, and then to co-develop action plans. You know, and I stress here on co-development because more often than not, we tend to think that the solutions that we put forth, right, are the best. And it isn't until you have actually validated and tested it, right? So sometimes you can have the best policies in the world, but, you know, you might fail when it comes to implementation. So for me, it's really about getting all these different stakeholders working together, making sure that everyone's voices are heard, and then to test and validate. There's no such thing as a perfect solution at first go, but I think it's very important for us to prioritize progress over perfection and to continuously work towards continuous improvement.
Thank you so much for speaking with me. That was sustainability and climate change expert, Dr. Rene Siu. That wraps up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off the evening. Thank you so much for watching and good night.